listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. The term "the drunkard's walk," as author Leonard Mlodinow explains, comes from a mathematical term describing random motion. Perhaps it can also be a metaphor for our lives. The theory of randomness, he writes, is fundamentally a codification of common sense. But he points out as well that the theory of randomness is also a field of subtlety, a field in which great experts have been famously wrong and expert gamblers famously correct. For Mlodinow, "there but for the grace of God" is a mathematical, if not theological, truth. Perhaps my Russian grandmother, who survived civil wars and a revolution, understood this very well. She would just shrug her shoulders, put her palms up like this, and say, "Listen, everything is unbelievable, but what can we do?" Tonight's special guest, Leonard Mlodinow, received his doctorate in physics from UC Berkeley, was an Alexander von Humboldt Fellow at the Max Planck Institute, and now teaches future scientists at Caltech about randomness. Along the way, very interesting, he's written for the television series MacGyver and Star Trek: The Next Generation. His previous books include Euclid's Window, The Story of Geometry, From Parallel Lines to Hyperspace, Feynman's Rainbow, A Search for Beauty in Physics and in Life, and with Stephen Hawking's A Briefer History of Time. In conversation with Leonard Mlodinow tonight is Casey Cole, currently on the faculty at the USC Annenberg School of Journalism. Previously, she was the science correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and she's written for many publications, including the New York Times and the New Yorker. She's been honored with numerous prizes, including the American Institute of Physics Science Writing Prize and the LA Times Award for Best Explanatory Journalism. She's also the author of 7 nonfiction books, including most recently, Something Incredibly Wonderful Happens, Frank Oppenheimer and the World He Made Up. And if you come back exactly 2 weeks from tonight, Casey will be discussing that book with 2 other fine biographers. So please join us for that as well. Now please join me in welcoming Leonard Mlodinow and Casey Cole to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you. Now you thought you were coming here to sit passively and enjoy our little conversation, but actually I'd like you to work a little bit. Since I'm a scientist, I want to do an experiment on you. So if you don't mind, but you don't have to. We will talk about this later, but before we start, we'll just do a little. And then afterwards, I hope the conversation will make the work have been worthwhile. But I'd like to divide you into 2 groups, okay? So you guys from the center this way are group 1, and you guys are group 2, okay? Great. Now, here's the rules. Nobody talk. And group 2, if you could, please turn toward the back of the room, away from the screen. It's important that you don't see this. You don't have to participate if you don't want to, but if you do want to, please don't look. Okay, now you guys look at the screen, and please read this silently. And hopefully you all have paper and pencil or something, and just record your answer. Okay, and one more question. Please record your answer to this one. Okay, thank you. Now, if you guys can turn away and group 2 look at the screen. Okay, so group 2, please read this question and record your answer. And now please record your answer to this question. Okay, now you can all look forward again. And somebody will be collecting this side and separately collecting that side, and we'll talk about this later on in the talk, okay? Thank you.
Okay, hello and welcome everybody. We're going to have a little fun tonight. I'm going to have a little fun with everyone too, with a little puzzle or game, guessing game, that it's managed to stump almost everyone, including a lot of really, really smart people. And when you realize what's going on, you'll just kick yourself in the head.
I'm not that flexible.
Think hard. I really like what you have to say about the theory of randomness being codified common sense to a certain extent. It doesn't fit every example, but it does fit this example. So let me give you these, tell you a little bit about a woman who you can imagine. Her name is Linda. She's 31 years old, single, outspoken, very bright. In college, she majored in philosophy. While a student, she was deeply concerned with discrimination and social justice, etc. So here's some statements I'm going to make, and see which one you think is most likely to be true. Linda is active in this feminist movement. That's number one. Linda is a psychiatric social worker. Linda works in a bookstore and takes yoga classes. Linda is a bank teller and active in the feminist movement. Linda is a teacher in an elementary school. Linda is a member of the League of Women Voters. Linda is a bank teller, or Linda is an insurance salesperson. So, does anybody want to give me an answer of what they thought would be probably the most likely? Uh-huh. Well, actually, not. That is, you know, in a way, I got fooled into making a case of two different attributes. Obviously, if Linda is a feminist, it's much more probable that Linda would be a feminist than it would be Linda is a feminist and a bank teller, or that anybody is anything and anything else, because you're already dividing your group up. And when you think about that, that just seems so obvious.
Well, I think three of the choices were, if I remember the book, mm-hmm. which is a while ago, one is Linda is a bank teller, one is Linda is in the feminist movement, and one is Linda is a bank teller and in the feminist movement.
Exactly.
Okay.
And 80% of the, in that three-choice experiment, 80% of the subjects ranked the probability that Linda is a bank teller and active in the feminist movement higher than Linda is a bank teller, which is pretty astonishing. So at sometimes probability is just common sense.
So do you see what's going on? So we say that her characteristics would be that she would be a bank, she would be in the feminist movement. So that's what the backstory was. And then when we ask, please rank these three, let's say, bank teller, feminist movement, and bank teller and in the feminist movement. And so people go, oh, feminist movement, that's the most, that's very likely. And then they go, well, bank teller and feminist movement because she's obviously a feminist. And they go, the third one is bank teller, right? But that's not true because bank teller includes bank teller and feminist movement, right? It also includes bank teller and not in the feminist movement. So it's by definition more likely that she's a bank teller than that she's a bank teller and in the feminist movement. And that's what tends to throw people. When you think about it, it makes sense. But when you're just going through life, you tend not to think that way, and you can make that mistake.
Exactly. And this is a wonderful book, by the way. It's very amusing, and it's full of historical anecdotes. And one of the things that will make you feel a little shameful almost of our society is how far it goes back that people really understood numbers. There's a lot of history of mathematics and numbers and how the Romans really didn't have much use for math, except they did for probabilities because it was practical. And you have Cicero talking about people who actually believed that the gods would intervene if they happened to be lucky in gambling. And he says, are we going to be so feeble-minded then as to affirm that such a thing happened by the personal intervention of Venus rather than by pure luck? I mean, this is Cicero talking, and yet we still believe.
Why don't we have politicians like that these days anymore? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. know, but these...
They compare us to Rome, but we don't even have Cicero, so...
These things have very serious consequences, and I think we should, you know, make a point of talking about a lot of them, because some of them are really astonishing. One of them that really surprised me was, and I do often teach in my classes about the fact that we have logic problems when we talk about whether or not DNA can actually convict somebody, and there's always some probability, usually one in a million or one in 10 million, that the DNA matches are randomly the same. So people have in their heads this idea, well, it's only one in a million or one in 10 million chance, so we can write that off. But in fact, there's a one in 100 chance of a lab error in analyzing DNA, which of course makes the one in a million number completely irrelevant, because it's the one in 100. If there's a lab error, it really doesn't matter what the random probability of a match is. And yet that's not allowed to be told in courts.
Right, and the reasoning behind that is that that's an estimate. I don't think there have been any studies. That guy would know better, but I don't think there have been any scientific studies of that, but there have been estimates of how there have been studies of particular labs, I think, but of what overall the error rate is, and so courts, since it's not definite, don't allow that to be quoted in a case, but they do allow the one in a million or 100 million number to be quoted. So that's very misleading for the jurors. But I also talk about in the book, well, what if you were quoted both numbers? Because I think a lot of people would also make a mistake there. They'll go, okay, if the chances of a DNA naming the wrong person is one in a million, and the chances of a lab error are one in 100, what are the chances if you have both possibilities that there's an error? And really, the chances are roughly 1 in 100. You can just ignore the 1 in a million, right? Because the 1 in 100 happens so much more often. The 1 in a million is kind of irrelevant, right? You'll have a lot of the 1 in 100 errors, and once in a while, the 1 in a million error, but it's not the average of the two, which people might tend to think. It's the 1 in a million should not influence you. It's the 1 in 100.
Exactly.
So you can have a very... a very fine scalpel, but if the doctor's hand is shaking like this, it's not going to do you a lot of good, right? So don't go to that guy.
That's good. That's not in the book, I don't think. I like that.
I should put that up. I'll put that in the next edition.
I like that. But I was very impressed that this this guy who teaches at USC actually said, few students take probability in law courses and few attorneys feel it has a place. That just absolutely blows my mind, given how important it is. So there are a lot of different things I wanted to talk about, different kinds of errors we make in statistics. And one thing you talk about a lot is Bayesian statistics. And you had a little run-in yourself with a diagnosis that actually an incident that something parallel like that you were just telling me was in the news recently. So do you want to tell us about that when you went into what was a random, it was just a blood test for insurance,
right? Yeah, I had
a
blood test when my, I think I had just gotten married or was going to have my first child. And so we wanted to get insurance. And so we signed up for insurance and they did a blood test. This was in the late 80s. And so that we get two letters from the insurance company. One letter to me, which says, we're denying your insurance because of your blood test, which was kind of scary. And then the one to my wife says, we're denying you insurance because of your husband's blood test. So you can put two and two together there. And so I went to my local doctor and had an AIDS test done, and it came back positive. So he told me that the chances of it, he called me on the phone with the results and told me that, oh, the chances of this being wrong are 1 in 1,000.
And that you would be dead within, there was a 1 in 1,000 chance that you'd be dead within the decade.
No, there was 999. So, you know, and
really
back
sorry.
Then I knew probability, but I had never thought of applying it to you know, anything outside of physics. So, I was upset. And anyway, they eventually did other testing, and my eventually even the insurance company offered me insurance. Like, thanks, but no thanks at that point. But you know, we're calling the insurance company in Wisconsin. They're not giving you any information, and you know, it was really bad time. But I told my brother, who's a doctor, of this after the fact, and I was very impressed because he's probably one of the only doctors in the country who would have given me this answer. He said, well, of course, it's Bayes' theorem. And so let me tell you what that means, because probably some of you out there get medical tests for, you know, AIDS. This happened recently with a friend who had was tested for Down syndrome and it came back positive. Any of these screening tests, whether the chances they might say of a false positive are 1 in 10, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, like they did with the AIDS test, what does it really mean? So if the chances of a false positive on an AIDS test are 1 in 1,000, does that mean that if you're positive, that the chances that they were wrong are 1 in 1,000? And that's not true at all. What are the chances that it's true? Well, the truth is that knowing that you got a positive test and what the false positive rate is doesn't tell you anything. So when I got that test back, a positive AIDS screening test, my chance of having AIDS could have been 0, and it could have been 100%, or anything in between. And so from that amount of information, you can't tell anything about it, yet doctors always quote you just that information, and usually that's all they know. So what's the other information that you need to know? Well, let's look at it this way. Suppose you have, let's say, you have 1,000 people, and they're all taking the AIDS test, right? So if the chances of a false positive are 1 in 1,000, how many do you think on average will get a false positive? 1, okay. Now, suppose that, okay, so now I know that it's positive. How do I know if it's a false positive or not? Well, what are the other kinds of people? There's people who actually have AIDS, right? They also get, let's assume, positive tests if there's no false negative. So I'm a false, there's one false positive, and the question is, how many other positives are there that are real positives? Well, you don't really know, because I didn't tell you what the incidence is, right? So if everybody has AIDS, you know, or almost everybody has AIDS, then there'll be a lot of those, let me just give you just a number first. Let's suppose that the incidence of AIDS are, let's say, 10 out of 1,000, okay? That means that in those 1,000 people, there'll be one false positive and there'll be 10 true positives, right? So what are my chances then of having AIDS? It's 1 in 11, right? Because there's 11 people got a positive rating, 10 of them were real, one of them was false positive. So your chances, now you know that, now you have more, you know, once you know that you're positive, you just look at those people, and of those people who are positive, 10 out of 11 of them are real, and 1 out of 11 is false. So my chances would have been 10 out of 11 that I have AIDS, right? Would have been, if there were 10 real people and one false positive, right, and 10 true positive. I'm sorry? I'm saying, what are my probabilities of having it? So if there are 10 people in 1,000 who actually have it, and one who gets a false positive, right, then if you look at just the people who got the positive result, 10 of them are real positives, and one is a false positive. So if you know that you got a positive result, your chances of having the disease are 10 out of 11. But let's suppose, on the other hand, that only 1 in 1,000 people have it, okay? Well, if only 1 in 1,000 people, then there'll be one real case out of 1,000, and there'll be one false positive out of 1,000. So in that case, your chances are 50-50, right? And if there's like 0.1, which was the case then, it was about 1 in 10,000, then the chances were actually 10 out of 11 that it was the false positive and not a real positive. So what the doctor should have told me was, don't worry about it. Even though the false positive rate is very low, the chances are 10 out of 11 that this is a false positive, because the incidence is much lower than the false positive rate. So that's the way you have to look at it, and that applies to, that's why when they test for Down syndrome, they do the initial ultrasound test, and they're looking, I think, for a certain morphology on the fetus, and if they see it, then they think that that's a sign of Down syndrome. But when they take the next test, which is more accurate, there's a chance of spontaneous abortion, so they don't want to do that unless there's a good chance that this initial screening test was right. If you're older, you have a higher chance that there will be Down syndrome. So if you're older, the false positive rate is much less than, let's say, the true positive rate. So if you see a positive, it's probably a true positive. If you're young, the Down syndrome is very rare. If you're in your 20s, let's say, then it's the same false positive rate, but the actual incidence rate
is much lower. So the chances are that it's a false positive. So that's why when you're under 35, they don't do the second test. If you're over 35, that they do. So when you get a positive test on from some doctor, you have to ask what's the incidence before you exactly. understand what it means.
The heart of it being that the Bayesian statistics also bring into play if something happens and something else happens, given that one thing happens, then another thing happens. So
right, so it's new information. How do you reevaluate when you have new? So first I'm taking the test and I have certain odds. Now I have new information. I know that I tested positive. So the new information, you have to reevaluate everything and say, now I know that I'm not the general population. I'm in the population that tested positive, and let's analyze that population.
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting in terms of dealing with randomness. It's like the very first example I gave is when you can kind of figure out, kind of make sense. But a lot of others require tools because our instincts and intuitions are not really great when it comes to making sense of things in the world. And I wonder that's sometimes why people don't like scientists and mathematicians because they...
There are people like that?
I love this thing about Lavoisier, and that's why I wanted to look it up, because you didn't remember the exact quote, but because he'd become a tax collector to make enough money to actually support his science, he was in the wrong class during the French Revolution, and so he was sent to the guillotine. And the presiding judge said, "The Republic has no need for scientists." That was basically his answer. And apparently, Lavoisier instructed his assistant to count the number of words his severed head would attempt to mouth. So this book is full of really interesting stuff like that. I think some of the things we don't understand about randomness are so widespread and so important. I mean, just to give an example that we all know about, if you toss a coin and you get a long string of heads, people think that that's really, really bizarre and, you know, shouldn't happen and couldn't possibly be random. But actually, it's very likely that it would be random. And you tell this story, which I love, about the iPod shuffle, where they tried to actually make a program that would truly randomly pick songs for you. And people protested because a real random configuration may give them song two in a row or three in a row, and they really didn't like that, so they had to de-randomize the way it shuffled in order to make it truly random.
Yeah, that's exactly right. People said it's not random because they played the same song twice in a row. But, you know, I gave a talk at a high school, and so we were talking about coins. And so some kid claimed that he could flip a coin and always get heads. Now, this is interesting. That's because randomness depends on context, and it's something that you have to realize, that when you're flipping a coin, the reason we say it's random. And by random we mean that we can't say what the outcome is, that it doesn't mean that it's equal, heads or tails. It just means that we don't know, we can't say whether it's one or the other. We have to describe it by probability. But that's what we mean by random. Now, when you're flipping a coin, if you really could control your thumb the right way and you knew the height over the table and all the other parameters, or if you had a machine, and there is a machine that does this, why anyone would spend money on it, I don't know, but you could flip a coin and get heads every time. So according to Newton's laws, a coin flip is not random. It's determined by the initial conditions and the forces that are applied. So in some sense in nature, it's not random. But it's random to us because we don't have knowledge, number one, or control, number two, over the situation. So those are the two things that we need. We need knowledge of all the parameters, and we need to be able to control them. So we need to be able to know how the coin is sitting and how everything is arranged, and also control your finger. And that applies when you look at the stock market, when you look at sports, or any other place where there's randomness. So this kid says, I can get heads every time. So, hey, come on up. Here's a coin. I give him a coin because, you know, he could have a two-headed coin. I have to give him my coin. I don't trust these high school kids. No, even AP math kids, you know, especially AP math. I was an AP math kid. What am I saying? So. He flips and he gets heads, and then he gets heads, and then he gets heads again, and the kids are all cheering, and I'm going, oh my God, look at this, you see? The guy looks pretty good, so how many of you think that he can really do it? And they're all raising their hands that he can really do it. And I said, well, I told him he's got to do five, so we've got two more to go. And he gets tails. So, you know, it was a good illustration because that's not atypical at all. And I knew a guy who was a math professor, and one thing he would give to his students was he would say, if your mother's maiden name starts with A through M, go home and flip a coin 200 times and record it. And if it starts with N through Z, go home and make up 200, but try and make it random. And then bring them the next day, and I'll tell you who's who. So they bring him the next day. He doesn't know who's who because he doesn't know the mother's maiden name. And he's going, oh, no. He, you know, calls out the name. No, your mother's maiden name is this, yours is this. And he's always right, right? Why? Because the chances are, I think, 95% that if you have a 200 coin tosses, you're going to get a string of six in a row of heads or tails. But the people who are making it up never put that in. So he just looks for a string of six, and that's how he could tell, because people don't really understand.
Exactly. And what makes it even more difficult is, at the same time that we find it hard to see the patterns we're supposed to see, we're pattern perceivers, so we see patterns everywhere where we necessarily shouldn't see them. So we not only see figures in clouds and on the bathroom tiles and things like that, but we see
peanut butter sandwiches.
And, yeah, because we make...
And you can make money with them on eBay.
Yeah,
that's true. You remember, remember the toast that sold for, I don't remember.
The ghost?
A toast. Toast with the Virgin Mary on a piece of toast.
Oh, yes.
Instead of writing books, I should just make toast. But, you know, I could get probably every celebrity in L.A. They all look a little similar, so.
Let's go into business together.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things about that, too, is that once you make a decision that something is something, whatever it is, and no matter how wrong it is, when you get additional information, and there are visual illusions, I was actually going to try to show, but they wouldn't work here. No matter what contrary information you get, you still believe your initial bias, your confirmation bias is based. Any new piece of information that comes in, you twist it so that it will fit into what you already thought. And that is something you talk about a lot, too. It just, again, you know, some wonderful quotes from people... It's just hard to believe that Sir Francis Bacon understood this, you know, better than we do today, saying things like, the human understanding, once it has adopted an opinion, collects any instances that confirm it. This is in 1620. And though the contrary instances may be more numerous and more weighty, it either does not notice them or else rejects them in order that this opinion remains unshaken. And we must be seeing this, I think, a lot today politically, because people who agree with their group on one thing that maybe they really believe in, and then their group becomes nuttier and nuttier and nuttier, and they know they can't follow it, they do anyway, because that's their...
There was an interesting study on that. They took people, students, and they gave them research on gun control. And I guess they polled them first to see which were for gun control and which of them were against gun control. And they gave them research that some research said gun control... it was a death penalty. Okay, so some of them were for death penalty, some of them were against the death penalty, and they gave them two kinds of research. It was equally divided, half and half. So half the research said the death penalty prevents crime, it deters people, and the other half was stuff like that's it's useless and it's immoral, and they had them both groups read this, and they were wondering, you know, what would be the effect. And then they polled them afterwards, and they said, well, of this research, they didn't tell them that it was equally divided. You know, which were the preponderance of evidence? And the people on both sides thought the preponderance of evidence was on their side. And when they were done, they quizzed them about their beliefs again, and they were even more polarized. They felt even stronger. So they were looking at the same evidence, and they were picking out the stuff that supported what they felt. And they were remembering that and forgetting the other stuff, and they are reinforcing their prior opinions. And, you know, there's an example in the book, which is probably too complicated for here, but I gave a string of numbers. So just to take it away from the political arena, like I'm giving you a string of numbers, 2, 4, 6, okay, three numbers. And I want you to guess what rule I got them by. And people use exactly the same kind of reasoning. They tend to go, I said, you can give me those numbers, you know, give me sets of three numbers, and I'll tell you whether it follows my rule or not. And when you think you know the rule, tell me. So people will say, oh, six. So I said 2, 4, 6. They'll say 6, 8, 10. I'll go, yeah. They'll go 10, 20, 30. I'll go, yeah. And they'll give me a whole bunch of numbers, right? And they'll all, and then eventually they'll confirm what they're thinking, which is that that the numbers are increasing even numbers, okay? And actually, it was just increasing numbers. I mean, some people say, you know, it's always consecutive numbers or increasing even numbers, but very few people will come and just they'll try and disconfirm their hypothesis, and they'll guess something else, like 1, 5, 7 or 1, 5, 90. So. So that's just another, a mathematical example of how people, that once you have a hypothesis, you look for evidence to support it, but what you should do is look for evidence to prove it wrong. And that's how you get sure or more certain about your hypothesis, not by finding evidence for it.
Exactly, and I think that's one of the great things about science and math that I always really like. It's a kind of an error correction system, that realizing that our brain does not do a great job at intuiting what's really out there, that we have developed tools, mathematical tools and physics tools, to figure out what's real and what isn't real and what the probable error is and things like that. I don't know if your test is going to have to do with availability bias, but in a way, this seems to have to do with it, where you see a string, you look at the what looks closest to you, and you go from that, this jump in.
That's why, so who here is like me and thinks that whenever you go to the grocery store, you're in the longest line? So am I the only one? Because I think a lot of people think that. Why is that? It's because it's not true, unless you really are gifted in some odd way. And I always try and pick the line, by the way. I know enough to know that you can't really pick the line, but I always try to, when there's someone in front of you and they're standing there and they're arguing about, the chicken, they're being charged $1.50 a pound, but the sign said $1.49 a pound, then you remember that and you go, I always pick the wrong line. And when you just go right through, you're thinking about your kids or the stock market, and you don't even notice that you're in line. And so this is the availability bias. When someone says to you, think back and think back about the probability that you're going to be in a bad line, you go, oh, it's horrible, it's bad, because that's easy. Those things are vivid in your memory. And if they say, well, so that distorts your memory for the probability or for the frequency of things
and
happening.
And this has really serious consequences in terms of who's lying and in terms of judges and juries. I mean, I have heard before that you can usually tell a liar because, number one, they remember things a whole lot better than people who are telling the truth, which we know. But they also elaborate a lot more. And your book talks about the fact that evidence given to a jury, the more elaborate and detailed and vivid it is, the more likely they are to accept that, even if it obviously doesn't make as much sense.
If it's more vivid, it will influence them more. There's a study in there where they do a mock trial, and it had to do with some traffic accident. Someone backed up, I think, a garbage truck or something, or I don't remember anymore, but they gave the evidence in two forms, so both the exonerating evidence and the incriminating evidence. For instance, one piece of evidence said I knocked over. She knocked over. They were trying to say she was drunk or something, I think. And they said she knocked over a glass onto the carpet. And the other form of it was, she knocked over the glass on the carpet and made a big red splotch, ruining the beautiful gray carpet, something like that. And all the evidence came in two forms like that, a boring form and a more colorful form, right? And then they studied the jury's decisions, and they found that the juries who heard the incriminating evidence in the more colorful form and the exculpating evidence in a boring form would tend to find them more guilty. And if they heard the evidence the other way, they would tend to find them not guilty. So they were influenced by how vivid the evidence was, even though the actual facts in the evidence were identical. So,
well, one of the times this really came home to me in kind of a scary way, because I realized, I guess I really was a journalist. I'd written a story about something or other that was slated for page one of the Los Angeles Times, and on the way home I heard on the radio that there'd been a plane crash. And of course my first thought was, there goes my story, which immediately really bad. But it did get me thinking about statistics and risk assessment, because I believe it was at TWA 800 flight over Long Island, and several hundred people died. And that seemed like a lot. And that's really scary, because partly because it's very vivid. But compared to the number of people who die of hunger, not to mention traffic accidents,
well, and I was just
nothing.
Per the statistic the other day, that your chances of dying in the car accident on your way to the airport are greater than your chance of dying in a plane crash.
Yeah.
But people aren't usually afraid to get in the car to go to the airport, right? They don't buy in special insurance because I got to drive to the airport.
Yeah,
right?
It's boring. It's not as vivid. Actually, I had a very curious experience writing about fear of flying for Air and Space magazine once. This was a long time ago. And I made a joke about it because I think most people have some fears of flying, whether they admit it or not, and that you see them do funny things. You know, they have all their rituals that Eric Jong used to joke about. I have to step on the plane with my right foot or my left foot so it doesn't crash, but I can never remember.
But it always works.
But it always, yeah, exactly. But it always works.
People do physics that way too. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's a different talk.
Yes,
yeah.
If you beat the drums to make the sun let go of the moon during an eclipse, that always works as well.
Yeah, but then someday they notice that they forgot and the eclipse went away anyway.
Yeah. Oh, I remember I was telling you about Air and Space. So what was so funny about that, it seemed to me that the funny thing about fear of flying, and I wrote it as a funny article, was that, come on, you know, you're sitting in something that weighs 500,000 pounds minimum, and you're going to float in air. I mean, really. I mean, we know this cannot possibly be true. Except, of course, unless, you know, a cloud weighs about the same much. But the editors at Air and Space magazine were mostly pilots who flew all the time. So to them, it was as normal as driving a car. So they didn't have this feeling. And somebody used the example for me of, well, if you were in the Stone Age and somebody had a Ferrari and you said, well, that's a fast car, it would make about as much sense. What do you mean? It's a hunk of metal. How can it be fast? It doesn't move because you have no... It's not in your life. You have no experience, and you can't make any judgments about it.
Yeah, you'd probably be afraid to get in it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. One of the things
I would anyway, unless I had extra insurance.
One of the things that I think is really important, and I'm not sure where you're going to go with your... I want to make sure we have enough time to play the game, but one of the things I want to talk about a lot, because I think it's really one of the most important lessons in this book, is basically boils down to... how we judge people, for one thing, and also the importance of failure, that we see people who are successful, say, a CEO who has five really good years, and we shower them with money and praise and so forth. They could be a sports figure or whatever. And the same thing...
Not for you, Casey, though.
No, not for me. That's true. Sports. I said we do not talk sports. I don't... We'll
do questions later
at the end. That's okay. Just hold.
Unless it's about the Lakers. No.
Yeah. I didn't tell you that story.
Oh.
When I first got to LA and I was up at the Keck Telescope doing something, and somebody turned to me and said, "How about them Lakers?" And I
said, Lakers. Yeah, I can swim. Yeah.
LA. but anyway, that a lot of times these strings are random, really, and that we attribute things to people which actually they got through random chance and really do not reflect any particular kind of ability. And then when they stop having this great row of successes and have a year of failure, rather than realizing that it's simply the way it should be, regression to mean or however you want to put it, we say, oh, well, they lost their hot hand or they lost their winning streak or they used to be great, but something must be wrong with them. And I just thought that was a wonderful thing for people to know and think about.
Yeah, that's especially true here in Hollywood. So I talk a bit about Hollywood because that's with the studios, one of what they really reward are people who can pick the next big pictures, right? And the people who run the studios are all picked and rewarded according to who has their hand on the pulse of American culture, society, what they're going to see. And you can look at the careers of Hollywood executives, and so I picked a couple, like Sherry Lansing, for instance, and if you may remember, she was flying high for quite some time and had a string of great successes and very good good market shares, and then all of a sudden it went down. And after 3 years where it fell from double digits to single digits, she was just unceremoniously fired. And I have some good quotes from Variety about how she had lost her touch and was out of, you know, couldn't pick stuff anymore. And you know, to me, that there's a couple of things that are suspicious about that. One is you don't just lose your touch overnight. I mean, it might be that you know, my kids tell me I don't know what the hell is going on in the world, you know. And that's true. I don't know. So since I was a teenager, I have a different view of the world, and over time that can happen. But you don't, 1 year you really know what's hip and good and what appeals to people, and then the next year suddenly you don't. So that's one thing. And another thing that makes that suspicious is that, having written a little bit in Hollywood, I know that in movies, from the time you okay the money for the movie to the time the movie comes out is years. And a lot of things can happen. You know, the actors change, the scripts get rewritten 45 times, the climate changes, the competitive, you don't know what movies are coming out against you. So even that alone makes it hard to see it as a deterministic system where you can actually predict what's going to happen. So all these reasons make you think this doesn't make a lot of sense to reward people for that. What you should be rewarding people for is maybe how they manage the business, just like any other business, just like it's the car business or you're making steel. But if you look at their careers, what's good about this is that since movies do have this lag time, you can look at the executives that got fired because they didn't know what they were doing, and you could see what they would have done in a parallel universe had they stayed in their job, because the same movies are coming out next year whether they're still there or not. So I did that for some of them, and it's just really interesting. So with Sherry Lansing, after she was fired the next year, it said Paramount has banner years. I don't remember what the films were, but they had a great year. I looked at another guy, Mark Canton, who she had like 6 or 7 good years and then 3 bad years. He had a couple bad years in a row, and then he was out of there. And then the next year, they had one of their best years ever with his pictures that he had, you know, that the idiot had picked, and that wasn't there anymore. And so that was kind of fun in Hollywood. But can I just say one other? Judge people, I can say one quantitative thing here. So I did a little example, which I think is very enlightening to me. Suppose that the entire Fortune 500 are identical companies with identical CEOs, okay, and they each have a 60% chance of success in any given year, whatever that means. There's a success, you know. If it means not being Toyota, that's fine. Okay, so that's their chance of success. Now the question is, so they go through 5 years, and now we go and we're looking at them, and we're going to pick who we want to run our company, maybe, right? We're going to say, well, which of them were good and which of them were bad? We don't know that they all were the same. How well will their results, how true will their results reflect the fact that they're all the same and they all had a 60% chance? So if everything was deterministic and they had a 60% chance, in 5 years, 3 out of 5 is 60%. So they should, all of them should have 3 good years out of 5, right, if it worked that way. And if it didn't work that way, then there would be anomalies. So if you do the math, you find out that about 40 of them, of the 500, will have had 5 good years in a row or 5 bad years in a row. They would look like idiots, you know, or heroes, and they're all still identical. So about 40 of those CEOs will have a streak like that, even though they're the same as everyone else. And only about 1/3 of them will have had 3 out of 5 good years. And all the rest of them will have 2 out of 5, 4 out of 5, something that does not reflect their actual ability. And that might sound strange because you go, what's the meaning then of this 3 out of 5? Doesn't that govern what happens? And it does. The most probable, if you're going to say, what's more probable, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, the most probable one is 3. But there's a lot of other ones besides that don't reflect it. There's 0, 1, 2, 4, and 5. And the chances are great, are 2 out of 3 that you're going to be one of those, even though the most probable one is that one. So the chances are greater that you're going to be one of the other ones. So when you judge people by having 5 good years or 5 bad years or 1 good year, that's a mistake, because in mathematics there's something called the law of large numbers, which says if you've looked at 1 million years, then you can judge them that way. But if you're looking at only 5 years, it's not reliable, and yet that's what we tend to do.
And it's just like the coin toss to some extent. I mean, you expect to have those kind of random strings, and yet we look at somebody's position or we look at their salary level, and we think from that we can infer things that actually you can't, because a lot of it could be random. And actually, one of the quotes I loved best here, which I did share with my students today, was from IBM pioneer Thomas Watson, who said, "If you want to succeed, double your failure rate." And, you know, I think it's something that authors talk about a lot, and certainly writers, because one is rejected so much. Hey. And there's so many examples of famous books that had to go through 50 publishers, including Rachel Carson, Silent Spring. You had a lot of examples. I was thinking of the ones I knew.
Not only that, there were some great quotes. Not only, there was, like, John Grisham got rejected. Even The Firm got rejected by 7 or 8 publishers, and Dr. Seuss's books, and I have a lot of examples of that, but some of the more interesting things are when I have the quotes that the actual publishers sent back to them about their manuscript, their unpublished manuscript, right? And George Orwell, they said, nobody wants to read animal stories.
Yeah, that's right.
And here's a good one. I won't tell you who it was yet, but it was a typical account of petty family bickering. And they rejected that. You know what that was? The Diary of Anne Frank.
Oh, yeah, so, that's right.
So as an author, I find this very encouraging that there is this, play in the system. There's, you know, don't think everything's exact. They're measuring the quality of your writing. Well, the measurement instrument is, again, like the shaky hand. You know, and especially, you know, when you look back, all these books are highly praised. But so the question is, why is that? Why is the book highly praised afterwards, and everyone seems to, you would think there's a 99% agreement that it's a great book, and beforehand it's rejected 7 out of 8 times? Because that's all phony, the stuff that comes afterwards. And, you know, as one example, there was Stephen King was writing books, I'm so jealous, he wrote books so fast that he couldn't publish them all under his name because people just wouldn't want to buy one every 8 months or whatever he was writing. So he started writing them under a different name. I think it was Richard Bachman. But guess what? So Richard Bachman and Stephen King are writing these books, you know, one after the other. Bachman's books aren't selling. Stephen King's are all bestsellers. Do you think that it maybe, you know, just every other book was a good one? Or is it maybe something that's has to do with the fact that they expect, you know, they it's good because it's Stephen King's book, right? So that happens a lot. And these judgments, especially of creative things, are just not as... determined as we think. There's a lot of other things that go into them. One other example was they did a study of 14,000 people on the internet, and they got them to sign up to listen to music, and they divide them into 10 worlds. So there was 10 groups of whatever, 1,200 or, well, obviously 1,400 people each, right? And one was a control group, so they just got to go to the website, sample music, and download it. And the other 9 could see a chart of their world of what's popular and what's not. So they saw like the top 10 or top 40 of the, and these are all like obscure rock bands that these guys collected. This is a great study. So the question is, if you're number one on the charts, is that because you're destined to do that? Because your stuff is just so good that it automatically, unlike books, where apparently, you know, judgments can go all over the place. Is music different? That these guys are going to be at the top and these guys are going to be at the bottom because that's just the quality and it can actually be measured or judged? Well, no, they found that it was all over the place. Something would be very high in one world and very low in another world. And what happens, of course, is that people are following the charts and they go, oh, this one's number 4.
Must
I'll probably
good.
Like it too. They do like it, you know. So when you look at success and failure, whatever it's in, you have to be very careful because these things are not as simple as they seem. The only book in the whole history of publishing that one could say is, objectively speaking, a great book is the one that you have right there.
I was going to say, yes. Well, and mine.
And yours, of course, on all of your books. Right?
Yeah, I mean, we know that there are important exceptions. I'm wondering if it's time to talk about the results of your survey.
Well, can I have the results? Yeah. So.
And then we'll go to questions, because I know there are a lot of them. We could talk about this all day. This is a really, I highly recommend this book. It's a lot of fun and disturbing.
Okay, so this test was a little experiment about, so one thing that's important if you're trying to understand or use probability is to be able to have a good feeling for the numbers. So
this is another example of how I can play with your minds very easily and twist your quantitative feelings about things, okay? So I asked you both, everyone a question, how many countries are there in Africa? Right, that was the second question. So here's some examples of other groups, some of the other groups I've given this to. And if you'll see there, group 1 versus group 2. Group 1 tended to give answers like 69, 88, 58, 74, 65. And group 2 gave answers much lower, like 22, 21, 39, 26. So, wow, that's quite a big difference. So what was my abracadabra that where I from up here, made you guys, I influenced you? Well, maybe I didn't. So let me tell you what the answers that you gave were. So for group 1, your average was 60. And for group 2, it was 26. So how could I do that? Okay, the difference between group 1 and group 2 was that throwaway question that came at the beginning that may have seemed silly to you. Group 1 was asked, are there more than 180 countries in Africa? And group 2 was asked, are there more than 5 countries in Africa? So I picked those numbers because I thought for most people that would seem absurd. The answer is, of course, they're less than 180 and more than 5. But it does plant a seed in your mind. And that just goes to show how when we're doing quantitative thinking, we're very easily thrown off.
That's great.
It's
a wonderful example.
So, 54. Who said 54? What was your average? Your average was 86, so the average was 43. And the average, you know, there was a book called Wisdom of Crowds, and I think it's because everyone's, like, errors sometimes do tend to cancel. And the averages tend to be around 50. So
I notice that. They tend to converge on the right numbers. So, yeah, now we can feel free to take questions from the audience, which I can see a little bit. Yeah. You right in the front there with you, because I could see. Oh, I see. You need the mic, and then I'll try to make sure I can see the whole room.
This is a great talk. Apropos of your Hollywood story, too, there's a book by William Goldman called Adventures in the Screen Trade.
Where I quoted that book.
Yeah, time and again, nobody knows anything, which is.
Well, he had an executive in that book who actually said, because he was, I think, the head or high up in the studio. After his career was over, he said, if I had said yes to all the pictures that I said no to, and no to all the pictures I had said yes to, I think I would have done about the same.
My question is, though, I was struck by your somewhat jarring story about the blood test. And what is your thought? What are your thoughts about the wisdom of insurance companies using pre-existing conditions as a method to determine how much a person might cost them? And if you think that the barring of using of pre-existing conditions will radically impact the bottom line of insurance companies.
If I was an insurance company, I would not insure anyone who was sick at all. I would insure only healthy people, and as soon as they got sick, I would cancel them. And I don't see why any insurance company would do anything else but that. So the question is, why don't we have laws that don't allow that? I don't know. I guess to be serious, if one must. If you have, you know, I don't think it's fair to say you have to insure people whether or not they have a pre-existing condition unless you make healthy people take the insurance too. I mean, the bottom line is someone has to pay, and, to me, in a sensible society, we all kind of throw in the money, and whoever gets sick gets what they need. But, of course, there's going to be still some rationing of some kind because probably not everybody can get a CAT scan every day or an MRI every day. That has to be worked out in some way. But you can't make insurance companies insure people regardless. I mean, if they have the insurance beforehand, kicking them out is a good business. But, it's probably not legal even today, even in this country. But telling them that they have to insure someone who has a very expensive condition when they know it beforehand and they're not a customer yet doesn't make sense unless you somehow make people who don't have those things also take the insurance. Because otherwise, guess what would happen, I guess? Everyone who's really sick would say, oh, I'm sick now, I better get insurance. I mean, I don't know, it just all seems so logical when you think about it, and yet it doesn't work. So,
questions from other parts of the room? There was, you need to wait for the mic. I'm going
to
check.
Oh, yeah, I have to remember to repeat the question. Oh, no, he has the mic, so I don't.
Yeah, I was curious to hear more about the DNA false match thing, because I wonder if it's one in 100 of an error. That's relevant if, and only if, those errors cause a false match. So
right.
How would that be? Contamination of samples or what?
It's contamination, mixtures, or just simply switching samples.
So it has to be sort of a mislabeling accident, right?
Well, no. In some cases, it was other material got into the test tube, and it can, even if it's, it can be two kinds of DNA from two different people, and it's mixed up, and it still comes out.
But then, if that happened one time in 100, most of those occasions, you wouldn't get a match. You'd get some other random aberration.
Right. It was one in 100 false matches.
Oh, so you had to have a lot higher than one in 100 errors, because most of the errors would not lead to matches.
I suppose there's errors where it's not a match, and it's not a match, and it's an error. It's an error that either it was a match or it wasn't a match, but it wasn't a match to something else. So I suppose that there's more. Yeah,
it's certainly something juries should be.
But there were I actually talked about a few incidents where they actually somehow retested it and discovered the error. But I don't really know too many more of the details. I mean, it could also, depending on how big a case it is. People could just also check the wrong box. I mean, you know, if you're talking about medical studies.
Right.
But if it's, of course, a murder case, hopefully they're a little bit more careful than that. But there were a couple cases where they actually checked the labs, and that's what the estimate was. And that was some years ago. I don't know really what it is now. And it's a shame that I don't think they are really studying it very closely either.
You used another medical example that I thought was really interesting, too, that I'd forgotten to bring up. Also having to do with why that one in a million tends to stick in your mind more than the one in 100, even if you had both of them as being more exotic. And this was, again, Kahneman and Tversky, who did the most fascinating research on how people perceive numbers and probabilities. But in this case, they presented a group of internists with a serious medical problem, pulmonary embolism. And if you have the ailment, you might display one or more of a set of symptoms. And some of them, such as partial paralysis, were really uncommon, and others were quite common, such as shortness of breath. And they asked the internist which is more likely, that the victim of an embolism will experience partial paralysis or that the victim will experience both paralysis and shortness of breath.
Right. So when the rare symptom was combined with a common symptom, they thought that it was more likely than if you just have the rare symptom. Because the common symptom, it was the same as the Linda problem, a bank teller and something I know that she's interested in, feminism, they think is more likely than just a bank teller or just feminism. But it's always less likely to have both. So.
Well, I'm glad you let them off the hook. And then you say in the doctor's defense, patients don't walk into their offices and say things like, I have a blood clot in my lungs, guess my symptoms.
Right. So that is a bit of an artificial example. Right?
But it made me think. Questions from, I know you're right together. We can actually go from one to the other. If there are parts of the room I haven't seen, hold your hand up high.
Okay. Napoleon once said when he was asked why you promoted a certain general, he says, the man is lucky, which comes, right? Which was his reward was basically success. And the presumption being that when his luck ran out, he might no longer continue to be a general. So the overall question is, how do you identify skill and luck or some combination of the two in order to reward or promote people?
That's a good question. And the answer is that you don't, what I am saying is don't look at the results. Certainly don't look at solely the results, because you will have bad results from really good people and vice versa. So what you have to do, depending on the specific situation, is to look deeper. So if you're in a company and you're hiring people, I worked at a publisher for a while, and you'd get people's resume, and they had all these, of course, they always have triumphs on the resume, but I mean, maybe even check it out, and they really were triumphs. And then the person's working for you, and they're idiots. And you go, how do we hire this person? Well, look at all the great things they did over there. Well, maybe they didn't have that much to do with it. Maybe they were just lucky. So they had two great things. Does that make them a genius? Unless you're Einstein, he had four great things. So, You have to look at whatever the situation is and look deeper than the results. So look at the person, judge the person, do your homework. That's it's the same thing with the stock market. I have a graph where I rated the top 800 mutual funds in order, and I graphed on the vertical axis their return, and the horizontal axis is their rank. So, it starts high on the left, let's say, and it goes down smoothly to the right, based on results, based on the past. So now, if I'm looking at stocks and I look at individual stocks and I think, okay, I know, the publishing business, I happen to know now that Bantam is going to have a great year because I have a book coming out with them. So that's information that I know. I do my homework, I write the book, and I want to buy their stock and take cash in on that. That's one thing. But to let's say, oh, Bantam had three great years in a row, so they're going to have a fourth one, is a different question. And so these mutual funds, usually you say, well, let's look at the last 5 years and see how they did. I'll buy them. I'll buy the good ones. So I said, well, let's look at the next. So I took some old data and, a very nice graph when you rank them. And I go, well, now, it's a little bit later. I can look at what happened the next 5 years. And if it was deterministic and you could judge by these statistics, it should look the same, right? Nice smooth line or roughly the same going down from number one to say, now I'm not changing the ranking, I'm keeping the same ranking, so the same companies, it should look the same. It's because they're going to do the same in the future they did in the past. And if it's not, it looks like random noise. And I wish I had brought it. It looks like random noise. It does. It's in the book. And so whatever you're judging, whether it's a company or a person, you have to do your homework. There's no shortcut where you say, I'm just going to look at how I did last year. So that's what I have to, what I think about that.
Yeah, and in the book you actually quote Bernoulli saying one should not appraise human action on the basis of its results, which I liked a lot, except that you also say that going against that feeling requires a lot of character, that you not likely to win you friends if you stand up and say of the gloating fellow who just sold more Toyota Camrys, it's probably a bad example now, than anyone else in the history of the dealership, it was just a random fluctuation.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think people are so bad at estimating risks and so good at recognizing patterns that don't exist? Is there some advantage thinking like that?
Evolutionary psychologists study those issues, and let me tell you one little experiment. They take a person and a rat, and they give them the same game. You're seeing lights that flash red and green. And it's flashing green 60% of the time and red 40% of the time, but it's all mixed up, so there's no pattern. And the rat gets his little rat reward when he gets it right, and the person gets whatever, a human reward. I think the person got a buck, and the rat got some sugar water. Soon sugar water will cost a buck, so it'll be even. But so what did the rat do? The rat said, hey, it's green most of the time. I'm just going to guess green and, get my 60%. The rat maybe didn't know it was 60, but neither did the person probably. So the rat gets the rewards, and the person's going, oh, I got it. And they start trying to match it. That almost everybody does that. They go, oh, green, green, red, and they try and match it. And if you try and match it in that situation, you do a lot worse. So the rat outperforms the human. Now, evolutionarily, they say, well, if you look at people in the wild, let's say there are, you have to make a cost benefit matrix, and so what are the costs and the penalties for guessing right and for guessing wrong, or the costs, the penalties and the rewards if you guess right or you guess wrong, and presumably the reason we see patterns is that if we see a false pattern and we run, even though it's not a tiger, there's no cost to it, or if we dive on something that looks like food but it's a leaf, so who cares? But if you pass up the leaf or you don't run from the tiger, you get eaten or you starve. So, or if you pass up something that is real. So it seems that for some reason this seemed to be how it worked out. And it's very subtle because in the human brain they've done the same experiment on split brain patients who don't have the communication between the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. And one hemisphere is more logical, one hemisphere is more artistic. And so they've done these same experiment on one side of the person's brain. So if you show it the same experiment and you show the lights on the left side and have them use their left hand, then that's testing the right side of their brain. And if you do it on the other side, it's testing the doing everything on the left side of their brain. And they find that one side of the brain, the I think it's the logical side takes one strategy, and the other side takes the other strategy. So within your own brain, there are competing strategies, and you end up picking one of them or the other one, but it's kind of complicated. But people seem to be designed, people are definitely designed to find patterns, which is why we can do physics, and rats can't, right? But if we're playing this red light, green light game, the rats win. So,
well,
you know,
yeah.
But by the way, doing physics isn't why the people think that the reason the brain, human brain, got better is for social reasons. It's not really for intellectual reasons. So it's because there's an evolutionary benefit to living in cooperative societies, and that seems to be the driving force behind the brain evolution. So somehow patterns must be important in that.
But, being able to keep track. You're talking like you saw Alan Alda's, had a wonderful series on this, The Human Spark, where he talked about the number of relationships that creatures could keep straight. And when you get to chimps, it's, you know, it's 7 or 8 or 9 social relationships, but only humans can keep track of 100 of different relationships
yeah.
and how they...
Yeah.
So they definitely think that there is a reason there, that it's a keeping track of who's enemy, who's friend, who's kin, who's this, who's that, that has a lot to do with them, or at least was enabled by brain size. So that's pretty interesting. Let me see if there are any more questions, because I thought maybe we'd end with something from the news that... something recent. A few more questions? Okay, great. Good.
I just had a question out of curiosity, maybe you'd know or maybe you wouldn't, but randomization as it relates to information technology, because a friend of mine shared with me how there's a lot of government funding right now in terms of developing algorithms for like tech computer companies for like encryption and like identity authentication, because precisely like you said, in terms of patterns, for example, like poker gaming sites, and they'll try to have like on the back end have these like kind of like random equations, but there's no truly random sorts of like, you know, like the patterns or the cards appear, and people will be able to like hack into the systems because there is no true random like string of like information. Or I don't know if you know any more about that, but it sounded really interesting.
About creating random...
Because he told me, my friend told me that like essentially in like data technology, it was extremely difficult to come up with a truly random like set of anything.
Right.
Right, that's true. So in they used to use electronics noise. I talked about in the RAND Corporation published a book. This could be a bestseller, 1,000,000 Random Numbers. Because based on electronic noise, but then they found correlation. But most things, it's very hard to something that's really truly random, that there's no correlations in it, and that's a problem. But you can in the quantum system easily get random strings. So in Newtonian physics, where everything is determined, that there is a reason for everything, and it's not, you know, in some ways it's not really random. I mean, this is a long story, but you could also talk about whether there's a difference between a random way of producing something and a random result. So you could have a random system that's totally random and gives you 1,000,000 zeros in a row, because there's some chance that something, if you're giving zeros or ones, there's still some, if it's 50-50, there's still a chance, you know, 1/2 to the million, that you're going to get 1,000,000 zeros in a row. So if you get that, how useful is it for your friend's poker website? Everyone gets a king every time for 1,000,000 deals, right? But it's random, so you don't want that. You really want, in some ways, the numbers to be random, even if the underlying process isn't, and it's a mess, really. But in quantum, in nature, really, on the quantum level, there is what Einstein didn't like, which is God flipping a coin or throwing dice before everything happens. And you can actually use quantum mechanics to create pure, you know, truly random numbers. So the processes, there's companies that build these things now, but again, it doesn't guarantee that what you get is going to look random, right? So even this random, true random number generator could give you all zeros, and you know.
Because there's uncertainty and probability built into the quantum system, which isn't built into.
Right, there is uncertainty built into quantum systems, and in classical systems there isn't.
Right.
So
to make an algorithm, to make a set of rules to generate a random number is already kind of funny. I mean, it's tautology. You have to make a set of rules to generate randomness. So it's yeah. You can see why it would be.
Yeah. So it's easier. But even in a quantum system, there could be a bias. So one way would be if you have something, a spin, and it's pointed, let's say, 45 degrees between the X and the Y axis, and now you're measuring it in the, you know, in the X axis. Half the time you're going to get that it's up, and half the time that it's down. I mean, it probably means nothing to you, but you know, if you're not really measuring along the X axis, and you're just a little bit, you know, because we're not perfect in where we set the measurement apparatus, then you're going to be biased again. So, you know, these are tough problems.
Okay, way in the back.
I don't know if you heard NPR the other day. There was a thing on NPR about doctors and lab tests, blood tests, and they found that the blood tests that or the various lab tests that the doctors were based on whether they were there were some. Kind of, it was a blank sheet, or whether it was a sheet with some sort of basic tests on it. In other words, sort of recommended tests. And I think they found that these doctors ordered twice or three times the number of tests on their average patient, depending on the form that they used, this pre-printed form or just sort of the basic piece of paper.
I didn't hear that, but that makes total sense. I mean, they've also done studies, for instance, on people going to restaurants, and they'll order the special. On average, maybe 15% of the people will order the special, unless the waiter tells them what the special is. I mean, the special will be on the menu, but if the waiter says, oh, look at the special, then it goes up to like 40%. So, yeah, but I'm not sure what that has to do with randomness, but it's interesting, though.
But it sounds like in the first case, they had a lot of different things to choose from and check, so that there wouldn't that be availability bias in a way, also that they'd have all that stuff to.
I mean, I don't know.
Anyway,
it gives you a lot of confidence, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, I know.
I can go to my doctor with my own pre-printed sheet of the test that I want.
Yeah, exactly.
Say, here, hey, maybe you want one of these. You
know, oh yeah.
That's why they have all these commercials for the drugs, right? You go in there and you say, "Give me Cialis or whatever." I don't know. What is that? I forget, but but from the laughter, I can guess. So.
But
my favorite thing, speaking of that, is, you know, if you watch late at night sometime, if you can't sleep and you see all the ads for the Extends. I'm, what kind of country do we live in that these people make money selling that stuff? I don't know.
You lost me. Oh,
good. I'm not going to explain it.
Okay.
Think about it, though.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, but you don't do sports, so okay.
Okay. Do we have a last question? We're probably what? We're out of questions. Great. Okay. So I just wonder, just to tie it up with something in the news, if you would tell us about Barney Frank.
Oh, okay. The Barney Frank story. Okay. All right. We were talking about this before we came on, so this is not totally in my memory, but Barney Frank had been demonstrating for something, and they came up to him and they said, and I heard this on NPR in the interview, and they were saying, well, someone was challenging him and saying, don't you think that this is a waste of time? You're doing this demonstration probably for gay marriage or something, and don't you know that never has any effect and you're just wasting your time? And he goes, oh, that's ridiculous. Every social change that's ever happened has had demonstrations. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, now think about it. Maybe that sounds good, but that's the Bayesian mistake, right? It's the prosecutor's fallacy. He's looking at it backwards, because what he's saying is, look at all the social changes that we've had, and they've had demonstrations. But the issue that was brought up was, what are the chances if you have a demonstration that you're going to bring about social change? It's the other way, and it's a totally different answer. I mean, people demonstrate maybe over a million things, and one of them gets changed, or let's say 10 of them get changed. But you look at all the stuff that gets changed, and probably 10 out of 11 did have demonstrations, right? So that's just a case, and you know, it happens everywhere if you just start looking for it, this kind of false.
I think it's great, and I think one of the great things about this book is after you read it, you will see the world and listen to numbers differently. So thanks, everybody, for coming. This was really a lot of
fun.
Thanks,
Casey. I enjoyed it.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.